Native peoples left an indelible imprint on the land with systems of roads that tied nations and communities together and are exactly the roads that are now our interstate highways and the Pan-American Highway. So the problem is capitalism, which is not the same as commerce and trade. It's very important to separate those two. The Native people were vibrant traders. They were all, and that's what those roads were for, connected everyone for trading. But they did not make certain things commodities. They didn't make human beings or animals commodities.
That's Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamyan. This edition of AR features Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz, an indigenous economic model. The existing economic system in most countries is a kind of state capitalism. It produces enormous inequalities. Its extraction practices are environmentally destructive. Perhaps indigenous models provide a viable alternative. Chief Seattle was a Squamish chief in what is now Washington State. He reportedly made these observations in an 1854 letter to U.S. President Pierce. How can you buy or sell the sky, the land? The idea is strange to us. If we do not own the freshness of the air and the sparkle of the water, how can you buy them? Every part of the earth is sacred to my people. Every shining pine needle, every sandy shore, every mist in the dark woods, every meadow, every humming insect. And then he warned, continue to contaminate your bed, and you will one night suffocate in your own waste. Our guest today is Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz. A distinguished scholar, she's been active in the international indigenous movement for more than four decades and is known for her lifelong commitment to social justice issues. She's the author of An Indigenous People's History of the United States, winner of the American Book Award, and All the Real Indians Died Off. She spoke at Guild Hall in San Luis Obispo, California. And now, Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz.
I think we need ideas for what kind of world we want to see. We've been in survival mode for so long, kind of, you know, fighting off the Reagan administration and George W. Bush, and then not that the others were very good either, Clinton and Obama, in terms of the wars and everything. So it's not working out very well, this capitalist system, colonialist, predatory, dominating the rest of the world. So I've done, you know, for this book, The Indigenous People's History of the United States, and even before that, for a previous book on I did on the history of land tenure in New Mexico from pre-colonial times to the present. So three colonial regimes, their Spanish, well, for the Indians, the independent Mexico, and then the United States. So I've been looking a lot at, and others have too, there's a whole field now of Native American scholars who are studying, they call it indigenous knowledge. Some of what I have to say comes from the first chapter, and that chapter is called Follow the Corn. Pre-colonial indigenous Americans were able to support complex societies with extensive agriculture as well as building large cities and towns without degrading the environment. Indeed, the capitalist-driven invasion and destruction of these civilizations are now thought to have actually triggered the Anthropocene. That was the beginning of the looting of the Americas and commercial agriculture and cutting down the forests actually had an effect on the climate eventually. So we're, you know, in this 500 years of degradation, we're now at the earth itself is in a critical situation, which means we are, because it's our habitat. The arguments, you know, for a different kind of society, there's this sense that there's no other alternative than capitalism. I grew up in rural Oklahoma. We didn't have running water or electricity the first few years of my life. I love all these conveniences. I want to find a way to keep these sanitary conditions. It's not good for human health. To live in, very poor people die in these situations. So the idea is, that's not possible without a great deal of money. And you leave out what human beings are capable of. There's a kind of lack of sense of confidence, even in ourselves, that we can build something. But the colonial myth of a sparse population of Neolithic hunters and gatherers in Amazonia and North America, it's long masked the reality of the whole ecosystem of the Western Hemisphere and the interplay between these nomadic peoples and agriculturalists. So the indigenous peoples in the hemisphere have built economies and institutions that supported populations as large as Europe at the time, but without the motive of profit and accumulation of individual and corporate wealth. That doesn't mean they didn't have caste differences, and of course each society of the hundreds were different. I mean, they weren't all the same. But some of the most successful ones in the southwest of what's now the United States and New Mexico area, the irrigation farming, and the Haudenosaunee of upstate New York and that whole area up there, had very democratic systems, but very different from each other how they handled them. But capitalist accumulation and private property were not inevitable developments of human societies, as the Western idea of progress argues, nor is it true that there is no alternative, nor is it possible to sustain this system. That's what we know. It's impossible to sustain it and for humanity to even survive. So the necessary change will require more than sustainable development and an end to fossil fuel use. It will require a radically different relationship of human beings to one another and to the land. And by land, I mean the waters, the earth, and all the other creatures of the earth. So in a really interesting article, Sam Gray and Raj Patel, they write about Native Americans' relationship to the land, and I'm quoting from them, "Given the kin-like relationship to land, it is more accurate to understand its commodification not as a deepening reification, but as an enslavement. Just as people have a right to their land, the land has a right to their people, its people. This is the logical terminus of a line of thinking that begins with the idea of the cosmos as a living, throbbing entity of which we are an integral part and a meaningful part." Muskogee historian Susan Miller explains, in other words, environmentalism based on this assumption holds that a living, conscious being enjoys health or suffers illness. Ethics demands respect for the needs of such a being. Legal theory, following this logic, views any human practices that degrade the environment as assaults on a par with physical assaults on humans. Political discourse within this paradigm assumes that the invasions and occupations of indigenous lands have oppressed not only indigenous peoples, but also an untold number of the conscious land itself. I'm doing a lot of work on linking up the enslavement, the connection between enslavement of human bodies as commodities to buy and sell as a new thing under capitalism. It's a new reality. And the land itself being cut up and sold as real estate. that these are both living bodies, and this is the main accumulation of capital that created capitalism in the world. Right here in the United States, by 1840, with the Cotton Kingdom. So you can't talk about slavery and the plantation agriculture and the economic development of the United States without first considering the ethnic cleansing of that whole territory where that took place. So an intimate, long-term relationship with traditional territories also gives rise to indigenous systems of governance, social organization, and science. Philosopher Gregory Cajete from Santa Clara Pueblo in New Mexico refers to this as native science, the practice and product of a lived and storied participation with the totality of creation, entailing, quote, a wide range of tribal processes of perceiving, thinking, acting, and coming to know. But there are serious misunderstandings in politicized science about the civilization that preceded European colonization. And there is much that can be learned from the social relations and economies of those civilizations. So I'll back up to when humanoids began to exist on Earth about 4 million years ago as hunters and gatherers in small groups, small communal groups, that through their movements found and populated every continent. Some 200,000 years ago, human societies, having originated in sub-Saharan Africa, began migrating in all directions, and their descendants eventually populated the globe. And around 12,000 years ago, some of these peoples began staying put and developing agriculture, mainly women who domesticated wild plants and began cultivating others. And these were all earth, you know, and matriarchal-based societies, pre-capitalist. As a birthplace of agriculture and the towns and cities that followed America, and I don't mean the United States when I say America, I mean the Western Hemisphere, is ancient. It's not a new world. Domestication of plants took place around the globe in 7 locales during approximately the same period, around 8500 BC. 3 of the 7 birthplaces of agricultural civilization were located in the Western Hemisphere, all based on corn. That's why I followed the corn. These were in the Valley of Mexico and Central America, sometimes called Mesoamerica, South Central Andes of South America at 15,000 feet, terrace farming, dry farming, very arid, no rivers. It was an incredible agricultural civilization. And the whole eastern part of North America up into Canada and all the way to the Gulf and up to the Mississippi River. So these are, you know, these 7, all we ever learn about, or all I ever learned about in school, were the Tigris, Euphrates, and the Nile River systems. I don't think we even knew about the other 2, sub-Saharan Africa, and the Yellow River of northern China, and the Yangtze River of southern China. So during this time, it all happened at the same time around the world without people having connections with each other. So this seemed to be what normal humanity was going toward. I think the weakness of Marxism and why it's difficult to think about a new world without capitalism is that he made the assumption, as everyone did in the 19th century, the theory of progress of humanity, that capitalism was a normal development, just happened to happen in this little peninsula of Asia called Europe. But I think it was a mistake that humanity made. I think it's the wrong direction. If we admit that, we went in the wrong direction, you know, like 700 years ago. You might be able to date it to the founding of politicized Christianity and the Crusades. So all of these others, other than the American, the Western Hemisphere centers of agriculture, the others did something that didn't happen in the Western Hemisphere, and I think it's significant. They didn't domesticate animals for work. They had some pets, pet parrots, they had dogs, created beautiful dogs. They had dogs all over, but they were either sacred, considered sacred, or they were pets. But they didn't work animals. So that's a very, the animals weren't commodities to be bought and sold. So, little shout out for veganism, I guess. sneak it in there. So, instead of domestication of animals, they did game management. And it's very clear they were managing animals, a kind of animal husbandry different from that developed in Africa and Asia, and perhaps very significant, because they didn't go tromping around in the mud and woods hunting, like the mythology, myth of the hunter, and gets repeated by white men all the time, tromping through, and having their guns and everything. They brought the animals to them. They were able to live wild until they were taken for food. Indigenous American agriculture was based on corn, though. There are whole societies that from Tierra del Fuego to the Arctic Circle, and from ocean to ocean, corn was dispersed. And that's why I say follow the corn, because the migrations or how the hemisphere became populated, you have to follow the corn to find out, how it happened and where it came from. So indigenous agriculture, the oldest traces of cultivated corn have been identified in central Mexico dating back 10,000 years. 12 to 14 centuries later, corn production had spread throughout the temperate and tropical Americas from the southern tip of South America to the subarctic of North America, from the Pacific to the Atlantic on both continents. The wild grain from which corn is cultivated has never been identified with certainty. There's no wild, there's wild wheat, there's wild barley, there's wild blueberries or strawberries. Everything has a wild, where it's come from, where it's cultivated from. And not corn. And there's no evidence of corn on any other continent prior to the post-Columbian dispersal of Western Hemisphere agricultural products. The development of corn is a unique invention of the original American agriculturalists. Unlike most grains, corn cannot grow wild at all, cannot exist without attentive human care. Along with multiple varieties of corn and colors of corn, Mesoamericans cultivated squash and beans, which were extended throughout the hemisphere, as were the many varieties and colors of potatoes cultivated by Andean farmers beginning more than 7,000 years ago. Many of the areas that gave birth to agricultural civilizations, and this is the case where corn was a staple, were arid or semi-arid, so civilization required the design and construction of complex irrigation systems. In the sites of corn production, these irrigation systems were in place at least 2,000 years before Europeans knew the Western Hemisphere existed. The proliferation of agriculture and cultigens could not have occurred without centuries of cultural and commercial interchange among the peoples of the North, Central, and South America, whose traders carried seeds as well as other goods and cultural practices. So, just to give an example of the vast reach and capacity of indigenous corn production, the colonialists, you know, the French and the Spanish and the English, they were all in awe, you know, of these cornfields everywhere. They went. A traveler in French-occupied North America related in 1669 that 6 square miles of cornfields surrounded each Iroquois village. 6 square miles of cornfields. These are, you know, not huge villages. The governor of New France, following a military raid in the 1680s, reported that he had destroyed more than 1 million bushels, 42,000 tons of corn belonging to 4 Iroquois villages. So they had granaries, you know, if you've ever been to Buffalo, New York, the granaries, you know, for shipment there, those granaries were created by the Iroquois. They stored food, and because sometimes they had bad crops, so they had, you know, corn can be dried and kept really forever, and then brought back to life. So thanks to this nutritious triad of corn, beans, and squash, which are called the Three Sisters, the Americas were densely populated, well-fed, lived long lives. In Europe, the average age of a male was about 30 or so, for a woman even less. In many places, for the poor people especially, people lived very long lives. So the destruction of indigenous food crops was a primary method British and the United States colonial occupation and ethnic cleansing took place to make way for plantation agriculture. So then, so the population of the hemisphere was about 100 million, and just to give some comparisons, at the end of the 15th century, with about 2/5 in North America, including Mexico. Central Mexico alone supported some 30 million people. The city of Mexico was about the same size then as it is now. At the same time, the population of Europe, as far east as the Ural Mountains, was about 50 million. Experts have observed that such population densities in pre-colonial America were supportable because the people had created a relatively disease-free paradise. However, there were certainly diseases. Otherwise, there wouldn't have been doctors and surgeries. And they were, you know, they did have medicine, herbal medicine. They had surgery, definitely dental surgery, dentistry, and setting of bones. But more than anything else was hygiene, which Europeans hadn't figured out yet. They really stank. That's why they created perfume. They didn't believe in bathing, you know. One reason they thought the native people were very backward and savage was that they bathed so much. It was unnatural to bathe. So they were very hygienic, daily bathing, as well as ritual bathing. Water was life. Ritual sweat baths were common all over Native North America, having originated in Mexico. But above all, the majority of indigenous peoples of America led healthy, mostly vegetarian diets based on the staple of corn, supplemented in, you know, the ocean areas by wild fish, other areas, fowl, the famous, you know, turkey, and four-legged animals. So by the time of the European invasion, indigenous peoples had lived in and had shaped every part of the Americas, every inch of it. They had established extensive trade networks and roads and were sustaining their populations by adapting to specific natural environments, but they also adapted nature to human ends. without destroying it. So back to domesticating animals. Rather than domesticating animals for hides and meat, indigenous communities created havens to attract elk, bear, and other game. They burned the undergrowth and forests so that the young grasses and the ground cover that sprouted the following spring would entice greater numbers of herbivores and the predators that fed on them, which would sustain the people who ate them both. So Charles Mann, has any of you read Charles Mann, 1491? It's a really good book. So he wrote, rather than the thick, unbroken, monumental snarl of trees imagined by Thoreau, the Great Eastern Forest was an ecological kaleidoscope of garden plots, blackberry rambles, pine barrens, and spacious groves of chestnut, hickory, and oak. Inland a few miles from the shore of present-day Rhode Island, an early European explorer marveled at the trees that were spaced so that the forest could be, quote, listen to this, penetrated even by a large army. In Ohio, the first English squatters on indigenous lands in the mid-18th century encountered forested areas that resembled English parks, as they could drive carriages through the trees. Bison herds roamed the east from New York to Georgia. It's no accident that a settler city in western New York is named Buffalo. But the American bison was indigenous to the northern and southern plains of North America, not the east. Yet native people imported them east as they transformed forest into fallows for the bison to survive upon, far from their original habitat. Historian William Cronin has written that when the Haudenosaunee hunted buffalo, they were harvesting a foodstuff, which they had consciously been instrumental in creating. As for the Great American Desert, as Anglo-Americans called where I grew up, the Great Plains, the occupants transformed that too into game farms. Using fire, they extended the giant grasslands and maintained them. When Lewis and Clark began their trek up the Missouri River in 1804, they beheld not a wilderness, but a vast pasture managed by and for Native Americans. So Native Americans created the world's largest gardens and grazing lands and thrived. Native peoples left an indelible imprint on the land with systems of roads that tied nations and communities together and are exactly the roads that are now our interstate highways and the Pan-American Highway that was already a road from Alaska down the Western Hemisphere. This little just overview of pre-colonial North America suggests the magnitude of what was lost to all humanity and counteracts the settler colonial myth of the wandering Neolithic hunter. These are civilizations based on advanced agriculture and featuring various forms of governance.
You're listening to Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz, An Indigenous Economic Model. This is Independent Alternative Radio. You can order copies of this program and or copies of her two books, An Indigenous People's History of the United States and All the Real Indians Died Off, by calling 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. Or you can order online on our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org.
It is essential to understand the migrations and indigenous peoples' relationships prior to the invasion, north and south, and how colonialism cut them off. But these relationships have been in the process of being reestablished, these connections, with the international indigenous movement of the past four decades. So when Standing Rock crisis happened, There were delegations of Native people coming from all over South America, Central America, and Mexico, and down, of course, from Canada. So the problem is capitalism, which is not the same as commerce and trade. It's very important to separate those two. The Native people were vibrant traders. They were all, and that's what those roads were for, connected everyone for trading. But they did not make certain things commodities. They didn't make human beings or animals commodities. But capitalism actually emerged with the invasions and conquests of the people's land and resources of the Western Hemisphere. No one has put it better in one sentence than Karl Marx. The discovery of gold and silver in America, the extirpation, which means killing, genocide, enslavement and entombment in mines of the Aboriginal population, the beginning of the conquest and looting of the East Indies, the turning of Africa into a warren for commercial hunting of black skins, signaled the rosy dawn of the era of capitalist production. These idyllic proceedings are the chief moments of prior accumulation. So I highly recommend reading that whole chapter, Genesis of Industrial Capitalists in Capital. So nearly three centuries of rapacious exploitation and genocide in the Americas culminated in the birth of the United States as the first nation state founded as a capitalist state based on land and enslaved African bodies and their labor as its principal capital. The extension of the United States from sea to shining sea was the intention and design of the so-called founding fathers. Free land, free in quotes, was the magnet that attracted European settlers. Many were slave owners who desired limitless land for lucrative cash crops. After the War of Independence, but preceding the writing of the U.S. Constitution, the Continental Congress produced the Northwest Ordinance. This was the first law of the incipient republic, revealing the motive for those desiring independence. It was a blueprint for gobbling up the British-protected Indian Territory, the Ohio Country, so-called, this, up to the Great Lakes and the whole Ohio Valley, Kentucky, Tennessee, Ohio. So all that territory on the other side of the Appalachian and Alleghenies. Britain had made settlement there illegal with the proclamation of 1763. So in 1801, President Jefferson aptly described the new settler states' intentions for a horizontal and vertical continental expansion, stating, "However, our present interests may restrain us within our own limits, it is impossible not to look forward to distant times when our rapid multiplication will expand itself beyond those limits and cover the whole northern, if not the southern, continent. With a people speaking the same language, would that be Spanish? I don't think so. Governed in similar form by similar laws." So this vision of manifest destiny and imperialism found form a few years later in the Monroe Doctrine, signaling the intention of annexing or dominating former Spanish colonial territories in the Americas and the Pacific, which would be put into practice during the rest of the 19th century, starting with Mexico, then onward to world domination. So the Land Ordinance of 1785 had established a national system for surveying and distributing land, and as one historian has noted, under the May 1785 Ordinance, Indian land would be auctioned off to the highest bidder. The Northwest Ordinance of 1787 had rhetoric of guaranteeing indigenous occupancy and title, but it set forth a colonization procedure for annexation by military occupation creating territorial status under the federal government once it was conquered. And finally, when settlers outnumbered the indigenous people, statehood. That's why it took New Mexico and Oklahoma so long to get statehood. Conditions for statehood would be achieved, and then it could become an independent white state. The U.S. system is unique among colonial powers. I think it's important to understand that although there was private property in Europe and other parts of the world, and even in some forms of private property in Native North America, that, you know, there was private property sometimes. Among the Lakota, you owned your songs, for instance. I mean, like a copyright, you had to get permission to use those songs. It's private property. So it's not just private property, it's commodification of everything. And land had never been commodified into paper, you know, little slips of paper, deeds. Just like the African bodies were made into paper, they were counted as capital and collateral for loans, for building capitalism. And that's actually how accumulation of capital. So real estate, let's say the common law that we use for property law in the United States, really change it. Because if you go to England or anywhere in Europe, property lines are irregular. They're along streams or mountains. But no, they diagonal, they just cut it up into these pieces to sell as a piece of paper. That's real estate. It's still the basis of the U.S. economy. If you don't think so, think about 2008 with the real estate, which we're not really out of yet. It's a problem because real estate is still the basis of capital in the United States. So I think we have to think about all of that, not just corporations, but private commodified property. The idea of buying a house just to sell it at a higher price. Just think about that. That's not a home, it's an object. You're not really wedded to that piece of land or related to that piece of earth because you buy and sell it and go on and on. And I've never been able to bring myself to do that. All my brothers and sisters, they were always buying a house and then selling it. And when they got divorced, they had to buy another house for the next wife. They lost more houses than divorces. It's so strange. That's not the way we were raised, not owning land. So I think if we can start thinking that these things are kind of perverse, a lot of things that we take for granted are really perverse. As we definitely flinch when we think of human bodies being bought and sold. So we try to think only about African slavery as a labor system. But that's only a tiny part of it, the free labor. It was the commodities of the bodies that were bought and sold. That was Wall Street auctions. I might mention my pet peeve these days. I'm even writing a book on immigration to counter Hamilton the musical. Hamilton is portrayed as an abolitionist, as he didn't own slaves, supposedly. But he married into one of the biggest slave-owning family in the United States at the time, the 13 colonies, that became states. But not only that, this family, the Schuylers, they're the old Dutch, the real aristocracy of New York, landowning, they were among the biggest brokers. And he was the accountant of the family that bought and sold the slaves. You know, as commodities, not to work. They didn't have a plantation. And they call him an abolitionist and an immigrant. He moved from one British colony to another. Would you call Ben Franklin an immigrant because he moved from Pennsylvania to New York? No, I mean, that would be ridiculous. But the West Indians were just like individual colonies. So anyway, this twisting of history to create fantasies that completely obscure the real perniciousness built into the very founding of a system we live under. Capitalism is at its heart, but also this lack of human empathy that is so on display now, every day on television, from the White House. You also see yourselves and tens of thousands of people objecting to that. They know that's wrong, to not have human empathy. So that's the first step to a sense of collectivity and taking care of one another and being in a different kind of social relationship. Now it's not only a window of opportunity, it's the only way we're going to survive in the immediate political world, but also just simply finding ways to stop the global warming, some ways to adapt to San Francisco becoming an island. They said California would be up to the coastal mountains, just completely covered in about 50 years, just the oceans. An awful lot of urbanization on the coastlines. And then, of course, very poor, formerly colonized people in the islands, in the Pacific and the Indian Ocean. I know a lot of people are talking about cooperatives now, and this is, we want to think that through, and do we have the kind of social relations that will make that possible with our individualism? And I talk about myself too, with living in an urban area and, you know, having to take care of myself and not really having a lot of responsibilities for other people. So I think what you found on display in Standing Rock, if you followed it closely, was tens of thousands of people who went through there from April to December. I think it changed their lives forever. I just have knowledge of the tip of the iceberg, a few people I've heard and I helped get there. A teacher in the inner city in Chicago, where little kids get caught up in gangs. He's a white guy, but he's really a great pedagogist and teacher. And he called me up, and I've known him, you know, since the 60s. And he asked if I thought it was okay that if he took the kids on a field trip there in the fall. I said yes, and I put him in touch with a friend there who could host him and the kids. And these were like middle school kids, mostly African American. Well, they'd hardly ever been out of the city before, Chicago, so there's teepees, and you know, it was pretty, kind of blew their mind. This is the whole scene, but they were in a camp with the Cheyenne River Sioux. They came in a van, fully self-sufficient. All the food they would need, everything. They didn't want anyone to have to provide for them because the resources were very strained. But they were able to camp in that circle and participate in all the ceremonies that were done and learn. He said these kids are different human beings than they were when they went there. In some ways, it's a natural, you know, we've killed what it is to be human when we isolate into our separate units. We're just walking around as a little commodity too, selling our labor, looking out for ourselves. We're number one, or we will survive, and competing for everything. They saw a completely different society at work, and it's a very broken community. There's trauma. This was an amazing experience for the young Native people who went there, because, you know, the suicide rate is just astronomical. Indian communities, not just on the reservation, but even in the urban areas. And this kind of hopelessness, it's really high for all young people, but it's much higher for Natives. I mean, that was such a gift for people who went there. And it was kind of chaotic, you know. It wasn't all that well organized. But what came through was the reason they were there and an understanding of water. I mean, you live in a city and you don't think about water, of course, in Flint. I guess you have to think about it when your kids are dying. That's going to happen more and more, that they saw it as not just helping the Indians or supporting them, but their own communities, their own loved ones were at stake in this. And that's then what creates a really a whole kind of person to be an activist. It's seeing an interest in living in a different way, and there's something to learn there. There's always been groups of people like the New Age movement who want to borrow pieces like the sweat bath or certain ceremonies. But you can't just take those things out of context, out of the human relationships. And down in Sedona, Arizona, there are these New Age gurus who, well, you've heard about the sweat where he killed a bunch of people because he made it a macho thing. You've got to stay in there. It's just completely the opposite of what a sweat is about. You don't compete. Who can stay at the highest heat the longest? It's ridiculous. But these things don't work out of context. And I see this before that, of people picking up on Zen or, you know, different South Asian Hindu religions and just taking part. So it doesn't really change them because they're not really, still they're linked into the same competitive system and all. So I think that it's very hard to have those experiences, but I think there'll be many more opportunities. And already we see people coming together almost spontaneously. The airport protests and the women's march. These are just people really wanting to come together. This is the time, you know, maybe the last chance. I think it's encouraging too that a lot of people who never had gone to a demonstration before, or a protest, or a march, I saw so many of them interviewed on television that they had never done that kind of thing before. They don't know why they did it. You know, they didn't know why I went to that. But then they were very happy about it afterwards. I haven't had the answers because almost nothing has worked to rebuild a really vibrant mass movement since really the what I call a counter-revolution, against the civil rights movement and the society supplying. I give one example of multiculturalism. You can't knock it because the right wing they hate multiculturalism. But that's not actually what people were demanding in the 60s, what African Americans, Chicanos, Native Americans, what they were demanding was decolonization, and for Native people, for sovereignty, for a whole different system. So they get instead this kind of watered-down multiculturalism where we are all one, we're all together, and it's not, it's superficial, and it doesn't really change people. It may make them more liberal, more tolerant, which is good. That's much better than being a bigot and a racist. And then affirmative action was not called for, it was given. What was called for is the decolonization of the universities, completely, where they are linked to the community and not just little isolated islands, but instead affirmative action, so they actually is kind of a brain drain from these communities. Turns out. So the system is very powerful and rich and has money to throw at everything. There are unintended consequences of some of our movements. I helped create ethnic studies in universities. It became a real passion for me because I had been a teaching assistant to Ron Takaki, who was the founder of ethnic studies. Japanese American from Hawaii. He was a professor at UCLA, and he was fired after the first year. He was teaching black history, that was his specialization. And he's the first one I ever heard, this was in 1966, say the word ethnic studies. It hadn't existed before, or African American studies, black studies, Chicano studies, Native American studies. These have made a difference. They're mainly in the West. Back East, there's this total amnesia about Native peoples because they think they're not in their midst. Actually, New York has the largest urban population of Native Americans. And they're mostly from the East. They're Haudenosaunee, you know, they're Iroquois people. They're Lenape. They're in their midst. No, they're not coming there from Montana or South Dakota. And they don't even know they're there. They're stunned when you take them to some place where the Native people are gathering. Where are they? You know, there were any Indians here. Because they just, it's an erasure, you know, it's very hard to link up.
If you could just say something about visiting these reservations, these pueblos, when it's time for you as a tourist to buy things, to help them survive. Can you say something about that whole scene?
It's like going to a poor country, you know, going to Thailand or something, where the people are very, very poor and they just live by selling things, and their customers come from the European world and America. So that's colonialism that you're seeing there. They have to go move to work on jobs. Half of the Native population, it's estimated, maybe more, at any one time are living in cities, working, or border towns like Santa Fe. When I say border towns, I mean bordering the reservation. And there's a very intense racism in the Southwest, just like in North Dakota, South Dakota, upstate New York, against Native people that is old, and it's very complex in New Mexico because the United States colonized, already colonized place. The Native New Mexicans, Spanish-speaking people, call themselves Hispanos. They never used Chicano or Mexican. There's an elite, and they were the descendants of the colonizers of the Pueblos. But they're very dark people. There's been a lot of intermarriage over time. There's a lot of, we use the term mestizo, they being considered mestizo, some of them. The real elite are not mixed at all. They look like, you know, blonde, blue-eyed Spaniards or Castile or Basque. A lot of the settlers were Basque. So the Pueblo Indians, Apaches, there are two Apache reservations in New Mexico and Navajo, they had two enemies, the Anglos and the Hispanos, who took their land. You know, so most of their land was taken originally under Spanish colonialism. And was reduced. The Spanish had a system, reducciones. They didn't have to do that there because they were already living in towns. But missions in California, you know, they put people together and to control them in missions. So the Pueblos really served, you know, as a place where they kept their mainly religious sites. What you don't see there and you aren't allowed to see is the underground, the kivas, where they practice their religious. And there are about 160-some feast days or religious days a year. And at that time, they closed the gates to the Pueblo. You can't go in. So what you were seeing is, you know, just like a day-to-day when it's not a feast day or a ceremonial day, or else you would see just throngs of people in, you know, in the plaza there and coming out of the kivas. But you're not allowed to go in, so you won't see it. They invite certain people sometimes, but you just don't go in. And they're all like that, the Zuni and Pueblos, the Hopi, they're all Pueblos, you know, from the same people. And there are 19 of them in New Mexico along the river. But these are the oldest cities in North America, in what is now the United States. But it's still a colonial system. They're not guaranteed tomorrow. That guy who's doing all these executive orders could write an executive order to terminate all the reservations. That's a doctrine of discovery. You know, the state authority, the sovereign state. But yeah, the doctrine of discovery is built into it as a kind of genocidal intent still today of eliminating Native people.
That was Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz, An Indigenous Economic Model. She spoke in San Luis Obispo, California. Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz, a distinguished scholar, has been active in the international indigenous movement for more than four decades and is known for her lifelong commitment to social justice issues. She's the author of An Indigenous People's History of the United States, winner of the American Book Award, as well as All the Real Indians Died Off. This program is produced by Alternative Radio based in Boulder, Colorado. We are independent and part of the nonprofit media education organization, Rise Up. We are supported solely by individuals just like you. We feature progressive voices rarely heard in the media, such as Angela Davis, Arun Gupta, Richard Wolf, Bill McKibben, and Chris Hedges. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. Special thanks to Hep Ingham and Terry McRae. The Kronos Quartet performs our theme music from Pieces of Africa. Joe Ritchie is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamian. Thank you for listening.